amount that is due is reduced?
This will only, that's true, but this will only apply in those situations where spousal support is given in lieu of
a
share of property. So you would have to do that, because if the obligor died the day after the divorce decree became effective,
that would be
the
only way that I can see this working, is if you croak the day after you take out the policy.
Well, you could have a reducing term policy.
This type of provision is not uncommon, but it's usually applied in a child support context, okay, where the obligor has to provide insurance commensurate to what the obligor's responsibility in terms of child support, which also decreases over time.
I mean, I'd have to talk to somebody in the insurance business before I was certain about that. I like everything about the rest of the bill, but that part just gives me a little
problem. Well, I might say, Senator Brockman, that in this bill originally, we had it this that you had to break down and properly label everything. If it was child support, it had to be properly labeled. Property, it was properly labeled. If it was support, it was labeled such. And they didn't want it on the house side. They wanted to be able to mix it all up and combine child support with spousal support and so on and so forth, and call property alimony and whatnot. So that's part of the reason for this. You have to protect the person who's stuck to take their share of property in small monthly payments rather than just getting it.
And no, I want to protect those people too. I just don't understand the mechanics of this of this
well,
new language.
It's you would only take as much insurance as you needed, you know. In other words, if you had a reducing term policy that would go along with your payments that you owed, if you passed away, then you'd only, your insurance would go along with what was left to be paid on that property, and that's all you would pay. You wouldn't be paying for the property twice.
It just looks very fuzzy to me. Sorry.
Any other questions? Well, I've asked counsel to spend some time. I think there are some drafting problems in the bill. There's no question about it, and I'll ask counsel to get together with you, Senator Brockman, and make sure that that's straightened up. And so that will I want to thank you for being here. That'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3030. And we'll go to House Bill 3043. There are no witnesses signed up. I'll ask counsel to explain it, see if members want to act on that right now.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, this is a procedural bill. In an aggravated murder case under present law, the only two sentences that can be imposed are death or life. However, where a defendant elects to plead guilty to aggravated murder and the district attorney is not going to request the sentence of death, then the life sentence would be imposed under the provision of this statute. In that case, unless this bill is passed, the judge would have to impanel a jury after a defendant has entered a plea strictly for the purposes of imposing a sentence that by law they must impose. So it seems like a futile exercise, and what this bill is allows the court to give the sentence that the court must do according to law, and that's the life sentence, and dispenses with the unnecessary requirement that a jury be impaneled for that purpose.
I'd like to, John Collins might be able to answer this question here. Is it possible for a defendant to plead guilty to aggravated murder in Oregon? Is that provided by statute?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I admit not being real knowledgeable, having not tried a death penalty case in my county, but I believe that is possible. And if there was a guilty plea, under current law, there would still have to be a panel brought together to hear the death penalty phase. And what this bill would do would eliminate that requirement.
Right. I think we all understand that, but I'm surprised to find out that somebody can even plead guilty to aggravated murder. I guess you can, if you say you can.
I believe that's the case.
Because that's the threshold question. If you can't do that, then it's academic. But if you can, why, then this does bypass a kind of a academic or useless gesture by impaneling a jury. The jury can only impose a life sentence unless there's evidence of aggravating circumstances presented by the prosecutor. And so if the prosecutor isn't going to present any evidence, then the jury's got no choice, and so we might as well put it in the statute and eliminate the impaneling of the jury. The second question, John, you probably couldn't answer any better. Has this situation arisen yet, to your knowledge, in Oregon?
Yes, I can't tell you exactly where, but there have been cases where they did, in fact, have to impanel a jury. This bill, incidentally, was not at our request, though the DA's association supports it, believes it would be an efficiency measure. But to answer your question, I think it was Judge Gilroy who originally suggested this, and I believe he has sat on just such a case.
That's right. I think you're right. I see Bill Linden nodding. Was it Judge Gilroy's case? Yeah, Judge Gilroy who had to go through this process, so it was this bill is presented really at his request or his idea. Anyway, the committee members have any questions? Any discussion?
Just that the Oregon District Attorney's Association is at the request of on this bill.
Well, it's a gut and stuff, Senator.
Oh, pardon me. Now you've cleared everything up.
Thank you.
Okay. Language I can understand.
So, let's see. That would be... no witness sign. Okay, fine. Well, the chair will move House Bill 3043 out. Do pass. Any further discussion? Call the roll on that, please.
Aye.
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 Andy?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Aye. Now, let's see. Brad Morse leave. I want to take advantage of a quorum being here at every possible moment, so I may do some hopping and skipping around here. With reference to House Bill 2301, see, Senator Brockman. Let me say this.
I'm still a no, if that's what you're asking.
You're still a no. You understand about? Have you had a chance to discuss the
Morris statement?
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're all right. Oh, yeah. Okay, let's do that, then we'll get away from that. Let's take House Bill 2184, and then you can notify Representative Kopetsky that we're about to go to 3236. I don't know why he wants to be here, but I guess he wants to know about this. So go get him. So, House Bill 2184, Council. Yes, go ahead.
Yeah. This is a bill that corrects a glitch in a bill passed in the 1985 session. That bill provided that changes in fees only applied to cases after January 1, 1986, the problem is that there are some cases that have post-judgment proceedings, primarily family law matters. And if that bill is taken literally, you have to apply the old fee schedules to those continuing cases, which requires the courts to have a series of old fee schedules on hand and refer back to them. And the state court administrator would like this bill passed. It provides that for cases filed before January 1, 86, the old fees apply through the judgment phase, and in any post-judgment matters, any current fees apply. Linda Zuckerman's here if you have any questions.
All right. Does anyone have any questions? Do you need any further testimony? You want to do anything? Senator Hamby moves House Bill 2184 due pass to the floor. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Brennan?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Aye. Bill?
Aye.
Brockman?
Aye. Curious. Let's Now, I'll tell you what. House Bill 286. Well, wait a minute. While I'm waiting for Representative Kopeczky to get here, and I'm taking his bill next because Eric's only got two bills on today's agenda, and I wanted to give him a chance to leave, so that's the reason I'm calling these two up first. But while I'm waiting for Representative Kopeczky on the second one of those, House Bill 2869 is the bill that would abolish the Indigent Defense Board. There's a whole bunch of folks here who are signed up on that, and well, they're not a whole bunch either. There are three, I should say. Bill Linden's here, Sid Lezak's here, and George Reeves is here. And what, as I understand, what they want to tell the committee is a little bit of the history of this thing and why it's fallen apart. Now, if we don't pass this bill, we're going to have an Indigent Defense Board still in the statute books with no funding and apparently no teeth of any kind. So it's really not a matter of whether we want to continue this or not. I'd say we just about have to pass the bill. You don't have to pass the bill, but if you don't pass the bill, there's going to be an Indigent Defense Board in name only. And since I felt that the committee would pass the bill, I thought to save time that I wouldn't ask all these witnesses to tell us about the history of the rise and fall of the Indigent Defense Board in Oregon. However, if the committee members want to listen to Mr. Lezak, Mr. Linden, and Mr. Reeves talk about that, while I'll call them up. Otherwise, I'm ready to entertain a motion on the bill.
I will move the bill, Mr. Chair.
Senator Hamby moves House Bill 2869 to the floor, do pass. Now, if there's something urgent, first let me ask the committee members if they have anything they want to say. Do you have something urgent? Well, come on up, and if it's urgent now, you're signed up. Sid, I don't want to cut you off.
Talk
you
into
if
a
you
no
just
vote.
Changed their mind.
Yes, good.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator, I will not give you any history, but there are several amendments that I have to raise with you. On page 5 of the bill, upon the advice of the Attorney General's office, I'd like to amend it to delete lines 9 and 10. They have caused confusion over the status of indigent defense contracts. The intent of the legislation that created the board was that these be judicial department personal services contracts and not subject to the executive department regulations. The Attorney General's office is of the opinion that the current language is confusing and ought to just be simply deleted so that there is no confusion. Secondly, on page 13, there is a issue relating to the appointment of counsel for parents in juvenile proceedings. Right now, there's no statutory standard for the appointment of counsel for parents in juvenile proceedings. This amendment would set a standard in statute. You have an option here. You could adopt this amendment in this bill, or there is another bill up on Tuesday that I've spoken to counsel about that we could raise this same issue. And so if in the interest of time, it's better to deal with this issue Tuesday, I'm amenable to that. The other amendment is on page 13, and it's a technical amendment. In lines 26 and 27, there was a repetition of a line there, and so those amendments would
what
simply...
Page?
Page 13, lines 26 and 27.
It must be a different one. We were just on 13, on the parents' standards.
Try 14.
It must be a typographical error in my testimony. I apologize. There was an unintentional repetition of a prior subsection, 2E.
Comes help.
Okay, I'm sorry. It is page 13, but it's lines 32 through 36. There's a repetition. Those are identical sections there. So just a technical amendment.
Mm-hmm. E, subsection E is the same as subsection 3.
Correct.
E should stay in, 3 should go out.
So E would stay in and 3 would come out. And the numbers would change correspondingly.
Sure.
Chair, may I ask
Yes, Senator Haley.
Lennon, do you have problems with the standard, language?
I think that the language in the bill as it stands right now, it does have some problems, and what we're going to suggest to be amended to would be, counsel shall be appointed for the parent or legal guardian whenever the nature of the proceedings and due process so require. This is somewhat more consistent with a Court of Appeals case discussing this, and since the precedents in the area change so much, we'd prefer to codify only the due process standard in general terms in lieu of a more specific kind of or detailed explanation of what due process means in this context. Right now, there's no statutory standard at all, and we have judges all over the board interpreting the appellate court cases as to what is the requirement for appointing counsel for parents in these types of cases. The Fourth Amendment I was going to offer but won't would be that the Judicial Department be taken off the bill as its requester.
Something you'll have to take up with the Senate President. Get some member to take it up with the Senate President. I don't think that's something a committee can do. I don't know. I'll look into that because if it's going to be amended, why we can certainly do it easily. But I just remember the rule being upon motion made to the president of the Senate. But I'll check it out anyway. Who's the sponsor then?
The Ways and Means Committee.
Ways and Means Committee. Okay, I can understand your concern over that. Make a note of that, will you, counsel? Well. Now, counsel has suggested that we do the bill that may be heard Tuesday, and anything on Tuesdays is not guaranteed, but the bill that's anticipated to be heard on Tuesday, the counsel says would be a better vehicle for the language you referred to on what page?
Page 13, the standards for appointing a attorney for a parent. Just that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'd like some time to work with Mr. Linden on appropriate language. The bill potentially for Tuesday, it relates to juveniles and be appropriate to incorporate it in that bill.
Mr. Chairman, I have no objection to that.
Well, looks like we're going to have to do that. Senator Hamby, you want to withdraw your motion? Okay. Well, then that's okay. Does anybody have any questions of Mr. Linden other than those?
Are we going to then amend the simple amendments and pass it out? Is that what your intention is, and save the more complex third amendment that's been offered for the Tuesday bill?
Is that, counsel, is that your suggestion?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the first change that Mr. Linden proposed to the committee was on page 5 of the A engrossed bill, lines 9 to 10. Is that correct, Mr. Linden?
That's correct.
You mean the removal?
The removal, deletion.
Deletion. That Senator Cohen moves that deletion, moves to amend.
I'd also move in the same motion to delete lines 35 and 36 of page 13 and renumber the following pages. And, Bill, that should take care of everything except the
That's
parents.
Correct.
Okay.
Any objection to Senator Cohen's amendment? All right, that's so ordered then. And let's see now. Yeah, I will. I want to make sure now.
Don't we have to delete the paragraph, the question?
Don't we want to take this out?
On page 13, lines 32 through 34 also, correct? No, she just removed 35 and 36.
Well,
wasn't that your motion? I think we're going to have to delete both.
Those lines don't, Senator Hamby, those lines don't relate to what is the criteria used and whether to appoint.
Okay. We're going to do add-ons, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, add-on rather than deletion.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, then. All right, then Senator Cohen moves House Bill 2869 as amended to the floor do pass. Further discussion?
Okay.
Call the roll, please.
Brennaman?
Aye.
Rob?
Aye.
Bill?
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Kennedy?
Aye.
Wire?
Aye. Now we'll go to House Bill 3236. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. For the record, my name is Mike Kopetsky, State Representative in Marion and Polk Counties. House Bill 3236 is a simple policy question, if you will. Most counties, it's my understanding that in most counties, courts are going along with what this bill, the policy statement in this bill, and I know of at least one county, Lincoln County, who is doing otherwise, and essentially, if a case is in small claims court and if it's transferred to district courts, I think most counties or most courts are saying, yes, you don't need an attorney. However, in a couple counties like Lincoln County, you are required. This bill simply says that if you've got a case that's originated in small claims and it's transferred to district court for a subsequent proceeding, that you do not need an attorney. And that's the policy issue before you. I'd ask for your yes vote. Yeah, glad to answer any questions.
Yes, Senator Cohen.
This is going to confuse those poor judges who don't know how to behave without an attorney.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, last session we significantly increased the salary of the judges, and hopefully they'll they'll be able to manage. There's a just learned during the interim, I shouldn't use a phrase around here, but tort reform discussions, that there's an old Mexican curse which says, may your life be filled with an attorney, with attorneys. And so this is running counter to that.
Okay, now, I thought I understood what this was until you spoke, and then I had to reread the bill here. Now, you don't, you know, once in a while a case is filed in small claims where it's outside the small claims jurisdiction, and so it's moved into the district court, but that's not the case that you're talking
right,
about.
You're talking about
a case that processed in the small claims court, but there's an execution issued out of the district court, or what is that what you mean by supplementary proceeding
that's
in
correct.
Aid of execution?
That's right.
Yeah.
Still had to have jurisdiction in the small claims.
Okay, now you've got a judgment in small claims court. Why would you... Well, okay, now the way I understood this bill, and the way I read it right now, is you go into small claims court without a lawyer, you get a judgment, and... then later on, you want an execution or some supplementary relief. You go back into small claims, and right now, that's where you go, isn't it? You go to the same court, wouldn't you, to get a supplementary?
All right, Eric can help me out here. I thought you went to the district court.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I think that this would primarily apply in a garnishment situation where you are doing a judgment debtor examination, and I believe that's done out of the district court rather than out of the small claims department. Okay. I mean, it's a district
of course,
court judgment.
Being a lawyer, I don't practice a small claims court, so I'm not familiar with the procedures there. Well, I think I understand it. Any questions, the committee members? Senator Cohen moves House Bill 3236, do pass the floor. Discussion? Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Cohen?
Aye.
Hamby?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Wires?
Aye. Carries. Okay, let's take up council now. Erica, is that all you've got?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Let's take up House Bill 3059. And this bill's going to be a problem, isn't it?
No, I'm sorry.
3059, let's see. We've got one witness sign up, Becky Hampton from Motor Vehicles.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Becky Hampton with the Motor Vehicles Division. House Bill 3059, as engrossed, reduces the Motor Vehicles Division's workload in a couple of areas and may have an impact on the traffic safety and uninsured motorist programs that we administer. Under workload increase, I noted two items. First, the bill removes driving while suspended or revoked infractions from the kinds of major offenses that would make a person a habitual traffic offender. We would estimate at this time that that would reduce habitual offender revocations by at least Second, prosecutors may find that they do not need to purchase as many suspension packages from the Motor Vehicles Division for the prosecution of DWS offenses, which would also reduce our workload. Related to the suspension packages, under present law, we're required to suspend or to send all suspension revocation notices, sure, either by personal
Senator
service.
Cohen.
Could I ask the witness to speak up a little louder? It's just really difficult to hear you.
Yes, ma'am. Under present law, the division is required to send all suspension or revocation notices to serve them either by personal service or send them certified mail, restricted delivery, return receipt requested. If there is a reduced need for the return receipt requested items because of driving while suspended infractions, then we may come back to you next session. We would like to track that if the bill passes this session, and we could come back next session and ask that the return receipt requested requirement be removed if we can show a reduced need for the infractions. Under traffic safety and uninsured motorist programs, if we use volumes of suspensions and revocations that were issued in 1986, we would have approximately 74% of those being possible driving while suspended infractions, 14% as misdemeanors, and 12% as felonies. Unfortunately, we cannot predict for you the impact on traffic safety and uninsured motorist programs from this reduced sanction for driving while suspended. The impact, to some extent, would depend on the actions of law enforcement agencies, prosecutors, judges, defense attorneys, and the drivers themselves. For example, if the driving while suspended offenses that currently are dismissed upon proof of license reinstatement, or those that are convicted at the no driver license offense, turn into convictions for driving while suspended infractions, this could send drivers a positive message about traffic safety. Conversely, if drivers decide that maintaining insurance is more costly than driving while suspended and paying a fine if caught, that could have the opposite effect.
Questions?
Well, I have a question in your testimony here, or somebody's testimony. It says, the primary purpose for the return receipt requested is for DWS prosecutions, and I guess I don't sort of remember some discussions over the years that the purpose for the return receipt requested is really also to make sure that the person has in fact received the notice and isn't blithely driving around with their, other than prosecutions. I mean, there's some other reasons why I think you'd want to have it there. But. I suppose that's your idea of the primary purpose. Other than the numbers, could you explain what you've done, what you're doing with this bill? You're saying that you're counting, you're deleting these kinds of suspensions from the habitual driver record? Or what, tell me again what you're doing with this bill, other than...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Cohen, this isn't the Motor Vehicles Division's bill, and it's rather lengthy, but the way I understand the bill, the primary purpose is to make a three-tiered system.
Authority by the legislature, is that something that Constitution would require us to set forth in the statute? Gee, it seems like that's kind of basic. So it's so basic, it seems to me it can't be delegated by the legislature. What do you think?
Mr. Chair, I was present when that was added to the bill, and several things were added here by the House. The contempt proceeding, that was not part of our original bill. This was added because of the House Judiciary's committee's feeling that they believe the Chief Justice should adopt these guidelines regardless of legislative mandate, but they wanted to push a little bit to require that there be guidelines developed. That was the intent that was at least voiced by the committee members at the time of that amendment.
Any discussion of the delegation authority or not, Dale, your member?
Big pardon?
Is there any discussion of the constitutional prohibition against delegation there, or in that discussion of the... Do you remember any going on?
No, they were. Mr. Linden
he's gone.
Is not here. As I recall,
no, he's not gone. He's asleep back
he's just
there.
Hiding.
He would be able to address that because those questions were addressed to him. And as I recall the testimony, and Mr. Linden can tell you that, it was not felt that there was any delegation issue here, that it was simply legislative guidance that, Chief Justice, we want you to do something.
All right. Okay. Steve, did you have anything to add?
Well, one thing, Mr. Chairman, Steve Jacobson, for the record. On that Section 5, Mr. Collins thought it might correct one of the problems with the bill having to do with the standards for recoupment. But if you look at it, that doesn't deal with recoupment. It deals with setting standards for determining indigency. So it really has no effect on the constitutionality of what we're dealing with in the first four sections. It might be helpful to have such standards. There are adequate constitutional standards for appointing counsel and have been held to be so, I believe, under Fuller. It's not for appointing counsel that's the problem. It's for trying to get the money back.
I see. All right. Anything further? Any other questions, comments? I think the bill has got... Seems to me it's got enough merit that the council should spend some time trying to maybe working with John Collins or anybody else and to see if we can clear up these flaws in this. Committee members agree? All right. Well,
I may be in over. That's okay. You got plenty of votes. I mean, yeah, well, it needs clean. However you're going
to definitely needs to be straightened out. There's no question about it. We all agree on that. So, okay, we'll take it from there. Thank you. Bill Linden, did you want to add anything or not? No.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. On the question of the delegation, I don't recall any discussion in House Judiciary. This bill was part of a number of bills that went to that committee as part of a general push to make some changes in indigent defense. And there was no discussion of the appropriateness of the legislative delegation to the Chief Justice to set those guidelines, that I recall.
Okay, thank you. All right, we'll conclude the hearing on I meant to tell Steve and Dale to just stay where you were here, because we're going to go to 3377. House Bill 3377.
Mr. Chair, may I bring one other person with
Surely.
Me?
Surely.
Okay, thank you. My name is Dale Penn, representing Oregon District Attorneys Association. Detective J.R. Miller from the Salem Police Department has accompanied me to the stand, and I will say before he starts pulling things out of this box, these are weapons that are not loaded that were obtained from the Salem Police Department in searches, and Detective Miller's brought them just as an illustrative aid to deal with this bill. House Bill 3377 prohibits ex-convicts, someone who's been previously convicted of a felony under state or federal law, from possessing any firearm. That is the change from present law. Present law states that an ex-felon may not possess a firearm with a barrel less than 12 inches. Okay. Now, in 11 years that I've prosecuted cases, I've seen lots of cases where there's sawed-off shotguns, and I have only found one sawed-off shotgun with a barrel less than 12 inches. They're all cut at 12 and a quarter, and they tend to be a weapon of preference from individuals who have gone to the Oregon State Penitentiary, unfortunately. Detective Miller, in serving search warrants and in dealing in narcotics and other cases, I think will tell you that he runs across these weapons routinely. With the advent of the change of survivalist weapons and these types of things on the market, now there are attack rifles and all types of things that law enforcement runs up against that are legally possessed and are legally possessed by ex-felons in the state of Oregon. This bill tries to deal with that problem. We would like to see sawed-off shotguns, attack rifles, these types of weapons that are designed to kill people, prohibited from ex-convicts. And that's the intent of the bill. We have tried to deal with the issue of what about a person who's convicted of a felony, but he wants to hunt legally in this state. And so we have added a provision that allows the individual at the time of sentencing to request the sentencing judge to allow him, by a certificate, to possess a lawful hunting rifle or a lawful hunting shotgun with the permission of the court, or if he wishes to hunt after he's been sentenced, and this was added by House Judiciary, this was not my suggestion, but he may request from the district attorney of his county of residence to obtain a certificate that would allow him to possess a hunting rifle or a hunting shotgun. But that is the problem. I might ask Detective Miller to simply show you some of these sawed-off shotguns. And we've only brought three weapons with us. We didn't bring a whole bunch. But that's the reason for the bill. And we believe that it will be very helpful to law enforcement and to the safety of citizens and police officers in the state.
For the record, sir, my name is James Miller. I'm a police officer for the city of Salem. I've been a narcotics officer for about 11 years. I've been a policeman for about 17 years. The Salem Police Department Narcotics Unit, which is comprised of four people, has a run-in or a gunfight approximately once every 6 months. That's not a lot, but one gunfight's plenty. It's not as bad as it is in other places. The guns that we're running into most commonly are the sawed-off weapons, and they are designed with only one purpose in mind, and that's to kill people. And I've brought some of these things to show you, give you an example of what we're running up against. This is a
a shotgun that 12-gauge shotgun or yeah, 12-gauge shotgun that was sawed off. It's the size of a pistol. It's a little over 12 inches. And the only big game that's normally hunted with this is Circle K clerks. There's no animal or no reason that a person would possess something like that. Brought another one that's a little shorter. Same principle, another 12-gauge shotgun. And this one we picked up a few weeks ago on a search warrant. It's a little longer, but the same thing. It's about 16 inches. And the only thing they're good for is killing people. We're also finding that a lot of these people are making silencers for their rifles and their handguns out of mufflers from chainsaws and motorcycles and things like that. And they're quite effective. You can't hear the gun when it's fired. I don't really have anything else to add. I just wanted to demonstrate what we're running into on a daily basis out there on the streets.
Okay. Any questions?
No, I just...
Yeah, Senator Cohen.
I don't know. I don't know why we're so concerned about hunting. I'd soon delete that portion. And I also don't know why we just don't ban them from everybody.
Well, there are a lot of people that share that view, Senator, but as you know, this bill...
I understand that doesn't have... I have already checked the relating clause, Mr. Chairman. And it only deals with ex-convicts. I have looked at it.
You'll recall that when this bill was here before, I don't remember what was here last session, or whether it was 83 or both, but the objection has always been that there, every once in a while, somebody fairly decent gets convicted of a felony, and maybe he's been a lifelong hunter, or maybe he lives in the ranch. And so the fact that those people couldn't carry a firearm of any kind for any reason kind of made it difficult to pass the bill. But now this session, why they've fixed it up so you can still hunt if the judge or the DA let you do it. This probably isn't worth fussing with, but the language on page 2, lines 6 and 7, the sentence that reads, a person convicted of a felony in Oregon or otherwise, that might have been a little more smoothly put together. I don't know what otherwise means there. I suppose it means if you've been convicted of a felony any place in the world.
Yeah. That is not a change from present law, Mr. Chair. And it defines in the statute that what felony convictions on the federal level or from other states, what would classify as a felony in Oregon. But that is not a change from the present law. The only thing we're changing from present law is saying that it applies to all guns and then this provision to allow a hunting rifle or a hunting shotgun.
Except for the fact that it doesn't go far enough, Senator Cohen.
I'll move the bill.
Okay.
May I ask a question?
Yeah, we haven't asked. Yes, do you have questions,
yes,
Senator Brockman?
Yes, I do, and it really doesn't have anything to do with the bill. It's just I have always heard about sawed-off shotguns, the first time I've ever seen one, up close as I ever care to get to one again. But what is it that it spreads the shot out
more
wider,
rapidly.
More rapidly? Is
yes,
that
sir.
The answer?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Just something I've always wanted to ask.
It's very devastating at short range, yeah. And that's what its use is for.
One of these weapons was used to kill somebody, and it did the job very, very easily.
From me to you?
Yes, sir, with one shot.
Yeah, I imagine it would.
Go ahead, Steve.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Steve Jacobson from the Metropolitan Public Defender's Office. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I find myself in a slightly... interesting posture similar to Senator Cohen in that I don't have any problem with outlawing these weapons entirely. The weapons that are just designed to kill people, I would prefer not to see possessed by anybody, not just ex-convicts. And I would suggest that this bill, even though it can't be amended to go beyond ex-convicts, it can be amended to more effectively do the job on ex-convicts without having some of the broad effects that it does have, and I'd like to point a couple of those out. First of all, the rationale for having an ex-convict in possession law to prohibit the firearms has to do with the inherent dangerousness of these people who are convicted of felonies. And originally, when this law was adopted, and there, similar laws exist throughout most of the states in this country, the felonies that existed in those states were those kinds of things, inherently dangerous crimes, robberies, nighttime burglaries, aggravated assaults, those kinds of things. We now have felonies in Oregon for driving while suspended, unlawfully obtaining public assistance, food stamp fraud, criminal mischief if you damage something over a couple hundred dollars, which can be done with a kick to a car that's been made in the last 10 years, a little fender will get you a crim mischief one. There's just so many felonies, and there are people who are convicted of those felonies who simply aren't dangerous. And we'll be reaching with, if we pass the statute in this form, we'll be reaching all of those people rather than people who really can be identified as dangerous people. So in general, when we're looking at the ex-con in possession statute, we should perhaps be moving the other way a little, rather than expanding the types of things that we're taking in. There's always been this law about concealable firearms, and I agree with Mr. Penn that it's really kind of a loophole that these sawed-off shotguns aren't included. And it's, as you read the statute as it exists, it doesn't say the 12 inches. That's been something that's come down through interpretation and through the case law. And I would have just absolutely no objection to adding the word in the prohibition, which says firearms concealable upon the person or machine guns, which are now included, and we should keep them included, and sawed-off shotguns, and attack rifles if there's another kind of specific weapon that's not doesn't have a legitimate use. But when we outlaw all weapons entirely and then set up this very strange system for licensing and certifying people to have a certificate so they can hunt, we're doing a number of things that really burden the system and may end up being very unfair. First of all, the way they've drafted it, it's going to be totally up to the judge or the district attorney, entirely in their discretion, whether or not to grant these things. There's no indication of what they should even consider or why they should or shouldn't do it. It's absolutely at their whim. Secondly, if you pass this bill, you're going to affect everybody out there who's ever been convicted of a felony, even if the law was different when they were convicted. From now on, they will not be able to have these weapons unless they can come in and get a certificate. Well, you may get about 30,000 people knocking on the doors of the courts and the DA's office saying, I want a hunting certificate, and how are we going to deal with that? I think there'll be fiscal impact because of those things. I think those are most of my points. In my written testimony, I think I raised a couple, and I'm afraid I've skipped something. But I really think that the best way to deal with the problem that they've raised is to add the sawed-off shotgun and any other specific nameable weapon that we can talk about. Oh, I'm sorry. The other major thing that is of concern to me is that hunting is not the only legitimate use for weapons, that weapons are used for self-protection. And it's understandable and it's decent policy to say that people shouldn't have handguns because of the inherent danger that you're talking about. And our present law does that for ex-convicts. But to say they can't have any kind of firearm in their home for potential self-protection in their home really says something I think runs counter to most of our feelings and to the policy that I've seen people voice in this state. Now, if a person's not a hunter, they're not going to be allowed to have a rifle in their home, even if they have no intention of being a non-law-abiding citizen, even if they only want it for protection. Again, that problem would be addressed if you simply outlaw the sawed-off shotgun or the sawed-off rifle or whatever it is and allow people to possess these other weapons in their home for those other reasons.
How would you respond to that?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would say that the statute applies to a felony conviction for 15 years. It's the way it is presently under the law. We have done nothing to change that. The legislature has made a policy decision that these felony crimes show a disrespect for the legal system and for our society, which is a serious matter. And the legislature has made that policy decision and has identified these crimes. That's the basis for this crime to begin with. We are simply trying to close a loophole which exists. The excuses that we hear all the time, if we talk about 12 inches or we raise that to 16 inches, what we're going to see is 16 and a quarter inch of barrels. The only way to deal with that problem and the excuses on why this is a legal weapon for me to have, regardless of what it's designed to do, and regardless what kinds of new weapons are devised, whether they be exploding shells or anything else, is to prohibit them from people our society have decided are have no respect for the system and are serious offenders. And if the committee would decide that this bill is not such that it could be passed in its present form, certainly we would welcome the amendment of at least outlying by category sawed-off shotguns and attack rifles.
Well, there certainly is something to be said for the idea that a whole lot of folks out there that have suspended driver's licenses and nonetheless go out and drive, well, if they've had a conviction, I should say, but now they're reinstated and they're driving lawfully, they certainly don't fit in the category of the kinds of people we usually think we should keep guns and things away from. So I guess that's another approach. You could either categorize the type of weapon or you could categorize the type of felony conviction.
Yeah. Isn't there a violent felony or something? I don't know all the legal criminal.
I thought they said the current statute did that. Could you explain
Big
that?
Pardon?
Or doesn't? Okay.
It doesn't presently.
Does
it
not?
At common law, we mostly dealt with those kind of violent crimes. There was some nonviolent felonies, but for the most part, the felonies were usually had something to do with violence. We're no longer at that state. We've got, instead of 10 felonies,
Excuse
we've
me.
Got hundreds.
I thought I heard someone say this only applied to felonies of 15 years.
The statute in its present form, the definition of a felony talks about that it had to have occurred in the last 15 years. So that
so it's a felony.
15,
pardon me, I misunderstood entirely.
And
I'm sorry to interrupt, Mr. Chairman. I just didn't
understand. Sure.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair. I would simply say also that if that is the concern of the committee, I explained to the House Judiciary Committee that I would have no opposition if there is insufficient support to pass it as it is presently stated, to amending out, specifically excluding driving while suspended or unlawfully obtaining food stamps. It's a felony, those types of offenses, if that's the committee's desire. We just believe there are a whole large number of serious offenders out there, and we're trying to keep down the exclusions to a minimum because that's what our job ends up being, is trying to keep those dangerous people from floating through those exclusions.
If you took, certainly if you included all crimes, all felonies that were acts against persons, and we could all agree on that, I think. And then you took, and I'm trying to think of something else, I suppose certainly residential burglary would be, even though it's just a crime against property, there's nonetheless, it's a serious enough felony that I would consider that to fall in the same kind of category. But then where would you stop? I don't know how easy it would be to sit down and list those kinds of felonies. Well, counsel, did you have a comment?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I could ask Mr. Penn and Mr. Jacobson, I'm not well versed in Article 1, Section 27, right to bear arms law. I took a look in the annotations and saw that the statute ex con in possession of a firearm has been upheld as constitutional under that section. And having not looked at the decision, my question is whether that decision said it's okay because either we're dealing with a certain type of convict or we're dealing with a certain type of weapon which is concealable. I don't know the answer to that.
Mr. Chairman, counsel, I'm not aware of any decision that says that it would violate the right to bear arms to restrict the way certain people or if certain people can have guns, as long as that's rational and can withstand other constitutional attacks. I'm not aware of any opinion. Most of the general challenges to the carrying concealed weapons statute and other general statutes that don't depend on ex-con statute status have said you may not be able to do this for everybody in the world, but you can say certain people can't have these things. So I'm not aware of a constitutional disability with this approach.
Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Let's see. Well, I'll tell you what I'd like to do. I'd like to get Brad Morris has been sitting around here a long time. I guess, are you interested only in 2301, Brad? Okay. Well, as soon as I get somebody in here that I think will vote to send this bill out, we'll get rid of it, because I hate to have you sit around and wait. I think that right now there are three votes that would send the bill out. So if Senator Hill would walk back in the door, I'd call that thing up. While we're waiting, though, let's take a look at House Bill 3040. House Bill 3040 is the Victims Compensation Fund.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this was the bill that eased the eligibility requirements for victims compensation funds.
I recall the testimony on that the other day. I don't know who was here and who wasn't.
The staff measure analysis kind of gives you a step-by-step in terms of how the requirements have been eased.
I don't think there was any opposition.
I don't have any problem. I'm ready to move it if you are.
Okay. Senator Coyne.
Let me just take a look at it for a second. Okay. 2301, is that what? Tell me.
3040.
3040.
Oh, pardon me.
Crime Victims Compensation.
Oh, Mr. Chairman, I just
yes.
want one quick. We're really expanding it. Do we have? Is our money coming in?
How are we going to pay for this?
I remember when we first started this fund in 79, and we kept it so restricted because we had all these people who were going to come and request funds, and then everybody was all nervous because they didn't have any money for anybody if someone sort of sucked it up with their first and I guess I just want to know whether it's a simple matter, whether there was testimony, and
yes,
I don't see here that the fund is in sort of robust shape.
The executive director was extensively cross-examined by Senator Wires about where this money's going to come from.
Good.
And I can't tell you everything that she said, but she satisfied me and Senator Wires that there wasn't any problem in that regard.
I think it's fine. Someone's been working on it for a while.
All right, with you, Senator Brown. Senator Brennan then has moved House Bill 3040 to the floor. Do pass. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
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 Aye. Okay, that carries. Now, I would like to move out House Bill 3197. That's sometimes been referred to by its principal sponsor as the Grandparents' Rights Bill. It has to do with grandparents' visitation.
Mr. Chair?
Council.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, there are two sets of amendments. One set of amendments are primarily technical and clarify the bill. As you may recall, I did a memo for the committee dated June 1st and I indicated five problems. There was a rough consensus, as I recall, from the testimony in the committee on problems 1 through 4. There was an issue in terms of what we do with problem number 5. In any case, the problems indicated in 1 through 4 have been incorporated into the dash 10 amendment. The problem indicated in number 5 is a little more complicated. This was the class of persons, for instance, step-grandparents who were denied rights because the paternity hadn't been established, and other significant persons who become emotionally attached and significantly involved in a person's life. What I did in working with the legislative council in drafting dash 8 is to require that the court must determine from clear and convincing evidence, not just by preponderance of the evidence, that visitation is in the best interest of the child. So this amendment applies to a limited class of persons, only allows visitation if it's in the best, if the petitioning party shows by clear and convincing evidence that it's in the best interest. Nevertheless, I think at least Children's Services Division was opposed, fearing that all kinds of people were going to come in, intermeddlers, and at least use this and attempt to get access to visitation.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Brown.
In that 10, Council, the on line 5, would you explain local parentis?
If you look on the House amendments to House Bill 3197, and if you look on page 1, line 16, that right, that says that the petitioning party can ask for custody or visitation or other rights. Line 19 should conform, but doesn't. I mean, if you can ask for one thing, the court should be able to give you custody or visitation or such other generally recognized rights. So what that does is conform the statute, one to the other.
Just give me the interpretation of the Latin, would you?
Oh, other generally recognized rights of a person.
Local parentis.
That is a person acting as a guardian or a legal guardian for the child. So that would be rights, access to, for instance, medical records, meet with teachers, correspondence, telephone, any other rights that a legal guardian of the child would have could be granted to the appropriate party in this case. It just, basically the amendment tracks.